Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. Thanks for listening.
So I'm sorry, I was crying. This is a Spotlight Report?
Sure, let's go.
Okay.
This week on Spotlight Report, I am sitting down with Erin McDermott, who is an experienced optical designer. She focuses in illumination and non-sequential design, but also has vast experience across consulting, engineering, et cetera. And her background originally was in applied physics, if I remember correctly. So Erin, thanks so much for sitting down to talk.
Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah.
I've been watching the Spotlight Report forever and now I'm on it. Woo!
Yeah, great. I've been looking forward to this one because for listeners, Erin and I have worked together in the past, and I always think that you have a really, really insightful take on engineering problems and optics in general. You've done a lot of creative stuff. So first of all, how did you get into optics broadly?
Good question. So I don't know. If it's okay, I'm going to go back way back, way, way back to like high school for a second.
Yeah, perfect.
Because like I was not going to be in STEM at all originally. My idea of what it would take to be successful materially was completely wrong. And I think this is something that not only students still get wrong, but even adults who are experienced still get wrong. So like I came from a really poor family, and my dad was, we were told when we were kids, like, your dad's gonna die any minute now, or he's gonna be incapacitated, like it's gonna happen. So we always had that like on our shoulders. And so when I was a teenager, I was like, okay, I have to figure out a career that can not only support my own family, but like my parents and my younger brother at some point. So that was like my thinking, okay, what do I pick that I can be successful at financially? And that's still kind of like my aim. I'm not like passionate, like, I don't dream about optics at night. But like, I like it. It's fun. It's a cool puzzle. But it's not the thing that drives me. So my thinking back then was, okay, I have to pick a career track that I am better at my peers in, right? I have to be the top talent-wise percent of my competition. That's how you do it. In my mind, it was like, there's a race, the gun goes off, everyone starts running, and then the top three people at the end, they get the paycheck and everyone else dies, right?
Like, right, right. It's either you win or you're not, or you lose. So
yeah, and it's all based on like natural talent, right? And that's completely wrong. That's completely wrong. Because, you know, especially now with my perspective, and I'm sure, and you've seen this too, where you're coming from with how many years you've been doing this type of stuff, there are so many talented people that drop out of the race. And you're like, oh man, you are so smart. You were like 10 times smarter than me. Why aren't you still doing this? And they're like, I just don't want to. This is too much pressure. This is too much stress. I don't, why? And they don't care that much.
Right.
And so like at that point, so I was like, okay, I looked around. I was good at everything. I had straight A's. I was one of the top of my class. I'm like, well, that doesn't narrow things down. But when I tried to think like, okay, but what am I the best at compared to my peers? Really, it was art. So I was going to go into commercial art, not like to be a liberal arts major, but like, you know, find a way to actually make money at it. And then my senior year of high school, it was my first quarter and I got this really terrible grade. It's the first time I ever got a terrible grade on any assignment. And it was in art. It was this thing I was going to major in. And I was crying. And my teacher's like, that's a little bit excessive. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I just had to change my career at this moment.
Right, right.
I knew that if I continued on, I was going to be paying someone for 4 years to judge my artwork in a, I always get a little confused, subjective, objective, like in a subjective way. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
like, it's art, like, you can't do that. But then at the same time, I was taking physics because I still love science. So I was still doing that just for fun, actually. And then I looked at my physics classes and I'm like, this is so much easier, you know?
This is very much the flip side of most people's experience. I do art for fun and it's easier, and I have to do the physics.
No, art class was the worst. And I was like also staying after class and asking my physics teacher different questions, because I was absolutely fascinated by physics. And so I dropped art right then. And then my last half of my senior year, I picked up pre-calculus because I'm like, yeah, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing. I'm going to do applied physics, though. I'm not going to be some airy-fairy theoretical physics. I know that I need to pay for my degree. And then maybe eventually I can get into theoretical, because I did love it, that side of it. But I needed to be practical. So there is a whole semester of pre-calculus that I have no idea about even still. But then, okay, so I grew up in Rochester, New York. And when people hear that, you're like, oh, optics. So you went to U of R, you went to RIT. Like, nope, no, I didn't. Why not? So like I said, I wanted to do applied physics because I wanted to get a job so I could pay for the education, because I had no cosigner. I had no one to help me. I had nothing. I was completely on my own. You know, like, you graduate from high school and it's like, okay, here's what a college education costs. Here's what you have. Nothing. Figure it out. Right. What do you do? So I was like, okay, co-op is going to be really important, not just to get a job afterwards, but to pay for it as I'm going along.
Yeah.
And so RIT does have a co-op program, but it only starts in your junior year.
And can you explain what a co-op is? I'm mildly familiar, but you know, for myself and listeners that aren't familiar.
So like, sometimes it's called internship, but a co-op is usually more involved, and you'll have more of a formal partnership with a corporation usually. And usually you'll stay with that company for multiple years or multiple semesters. So it's not just like you go in, you get people's coffee for a semester and then you leave. Like, no, you're actually learning skills that you need on that job.
So right.
You have real practical experience when you leave. For the school I ended up picking, it was more involved with that than that, because it was actually from freshman year. And then you had to complete a thesis, and it was a 5-year program, and it was 12 months out of the year, and you had no spring break. You had no Christmas vacation. You had no summer. Like, it was like boot camp.
Yeah, for 5 years.
Yeah. So with RIT, I decided against that because A, they actually don't have an applied physics program, or they didn't at the time, which is weird because they're the engineering school in Rochester. I was like, that's crazy. Okay, so you have a physics program and it has co-op, but it doesn't start until your junior year. Okay. And then U of R, they did have applied physics, but no co-op. So I was like, this is failing me. I have to go elsewhere. And so that's why I went to Kettering University. It used to be called General Motors Institute in Flint, Michigan. And it was the only school that I applied to because it was the only one that I could figure out I could afford somehow with the co-op and everything.
Right, right.
And I took a year off to just, I was delivering Chinese food and I was scooping custard to save up enough money to get to my first year. And then I finally made it, and I only had enough money to get through the first. So we had a quarter system. So mm-hmm. I only had enough to get through the first quarter. And I was like, whatever, I'll figure it out as I go along. And I was like, just getting there a whole year, like, no, one day off a month, 80 hours a week for a whole year, just to get to that one quarter. And then 6 weeks later, my dad had a brain aneurysm and the penny dropped finally, like the shoe dropped that I've been waiting for my whole childhood, you know? So I had to quit school. I had to give it all up. And I withdrew and I went back to Rochester and I got a job at the phone company. And I was an engineering clerk, to calculus at night, and still, I think, delivering Chinese food and waitressing and just
in between everything.
Yeah.
Else.
Yeah. And trying to like help fill the gap until my parents could get on like the welfare system. And then I got laid off from there. That was my first layoff, the first of three so far in my career. And yeah, so like I was 19 at that point. So like, I've never had this illusion that corporate life was stable ever.
Right.
And it ended up taking me another 2 years to get back to college, to Kettering. And they actually tried to take away my scholarship. They're like, oh, well, you withdrew. I'm like, do you know why? Because it's really important. Why?
But if right. I did, it wasn't like a casual see you guys later.
I'm bored of this. But then, so I finally got back in. I had to fight my way to get my scholarships back. And then it was like the dot-com bubble burst. So not only was I laid off from my, you know, engineering clerk job in Rochester, but then trying to find a co-op was next to impossible. And that took me another year before I landed a co-op job. So off to a great start. And I got to work in Federal Mogul. They're an automotive parts manufacturer in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I was in the R&D for manufacturing process technology. So that's just like the machines in an assembly line that make the parts better. And I got to work with a 4-kilowatt diode laser and sometimes set fire to things in the lab, but it
purely
was
purely on accident, of course, purely on accident.
Well, we didn't know it was going to happen. It was research, you know.
Of course, yeah.
And we also had a 6-kilowatt microwave. So when your boss tells you, hey, can you look in the chamber to see if we've created a plasma? Don't do it. Don't do it. Go to HR, whatever you have to do. So that was really cool. And then I got to do a study abroad term in Germany. And while I was there, I got to visit the Federal Mogul facility that was in Wiesbaden, and got to tour the factory there so I could like better tweak how I was making the manufacturing process for their assembly line.
Right, really. Right.
And then also while I was in Germany, there was a quarks and nuclear physics conference in Madrid in Spain. And I was like, okay, well, let me see, like, because I'm still not sure if I want to go into theoretical or how that would work. And I go there and I didn't learn anything about quarks or nuclear physics. All I know is that there were multiple people crying. Like, these people were berating each other and screaming at each other. And I was like, oh my God, this is like art class. And so that's when I decided, like, no, I don't want to go theoretical, forget that. And then at the same time, in Kettering for my applied physics program, you had to pick a concentration. So the reason that I got pulled into Federal Mogul to work with lasers is because I picked the optics concentration. And that was just four classes, like optics one, optics two, photonics and fiber optics. And then I don't know what the fourth one was, but
not important.
Not important. Because I'm barely using it now. But that's my whole career is based on, you know, those four classes, basically. But that's not true.
And well, right. I mean, of course. But excluding that fourth class, I'm kind of curious, you know, optics one, optics two, does that mean kind of like geometrical optics and that's the beginning and end? Or was there radiometry in there? Or
yeah, optics one was more geometrical stuff. And then optics two was the crazier stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Right. The technical term.
Yeah. And you know, like I only saw Zmax for like half the class.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember it. And one of my classmates later was like, yeah, we did see Zmax before. I'm like, really? I don't even remember it. And then I'm like, oh, you know, I think I remember now. Yeah. We didn't like learn it, you know, and we didn't really go and it was just like drawing.
Well, and yeah, I mean, I had a similar experience in undergrad. We used Code 5 and Zmax. And I'm sure we'll get to this. And, you know, I assume it's probably true for you as well, but I technically was taught a lot in undergrad and I learned very little, in my opinion, for optics or for Zmax or for Code 5. And it's not until you actually have to use it that you're like, oh, this is how this all works. I get it. That was my experience anyways.
Well, that makes me feel much better then, because I don't feel like I shorted myself with an education then. Because, I mean, I definitely for me, 80% of what I do now is from real on-the-job training that happened and just like figure it out as you go along training.
Right, right.
So I did my thesis at Federal Mogul, and on the laser technology that we are developing, which I can't talk about. That's the only thing. That's the only thing that I can't talk about, really. And they kept saying, like, trying to give me a tweet thing. So I'm like, guys, no one will ever read this. It's confidential. I don't care. Just give me my degree.
Right.
So that company actually gave me an offer, but at the same time, for a full-time job after I graduated. But at the same time, I was interviewing with Xerox back in Rochester, and I wanted to get back home so I could help out my friends and my family and stuff. So I was holding out for that. And what happened was, again, that was 2007. So this was like, still the dominoes were falling for all the different recession industries that were getting hit. One day Xerox calls me up and they're like, we are so sorry, but we have a hiring freeze and we really wanted to hire you, but we needed to fly you out here first. So we couldn't have sent you the papers yet. And then, so I go back to my boss. I'm like, okay, I guess we're doing this. And he's like, oh no, you didn't hear? We have a hiring freeze just starting this morning. He was like, what are you going to do? Are you going to get a job at McDonald's? And I'm like, no, Warren, I'll find something else. So for several months, I was like desperately searching again for a job back in Rochester. And serendipitously, there was a German company that opened up an R&D branch in Fairport. It's part of Rochester. And I was like, guys, you're going to need optics at some point. Why don't you just hire me? So they did. They created a position for me, which was awesome.
Oh, wow.
But that means you're first on the chopping block when the chopping block is getting chopped. So that was a constant stressor. Like, I had to prove myself. I had to bring in work. I had to like find things to make myself valuable in the company. And like the first thing I did had nothing to do with optics. My boss was like, look, the only way I can bring you in here right now is if you build this precision motion stage to test a machine vision sensor that we developed. And you have 5 weeks to do it. And
you've never done this before.
I've never done it before. And he knew I'd never done it. He's like, can you do it? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Let's do it. He's like, all right, that's why I got you this job.
That's the go get him attitude he was looking for.
Yeah. So that was my first project. And me and my boss flew to Germany to like sell this to the bigger company. And on the way home, he's like, okay, we got the contract. That was great. Good job. By the way, that was $180,000 sale we just made per year, returning revenue. And I was like, oh my God, why didn't you tell me? He's like, because I didn't want you to freak out.
Right.
So then after that, they wanted to send me back over to Germany to train with the other engineers over there, because I was the only optics person in the United States, and headquarters was in Germany, just south of Stuttgart. So I went over there to train with my other optics people. And the idea was that I was going to bring back work eventually. I was going to learn some of the projects that they were working on at that time. And then I could know enough about them and how they work to be able to work with them really easily, even though we're, you know, an ocean apart. But my German boss, I don't think, was really keen on that. So instead of letting me pick up any of the projects that were currently going on, he instead had me build a BRDF measurement machine, which at the time I was extremely angry about. Because he could have just bought one, but but that was a way where he could have had me work for really cheap, because at the time it was like almost $1.40 per 1 euro that he was paying for me. And that work wouldn't go back to Rochester. That work was there because it was through the lab.
And can you explain just super quick what BRDF is/stands for?
Yes. It is a bidirectional reflectance distribution function.
Yeah.
And that's just like when you're creating models to use in ZMAX or ASAP or light tools or whatever to characterize how light bounces off of the surface, it's the reflectance. And you can have one function that will tell you what light is coming out at every angle. And that was really important, though, because they were building these sensors for industrial automation. So they're going in assembly lines and factories. And what you have to remember is your optical system is now the factory. Okay, so you can you know, build a system that works, but then you put it in a place where they have a window above and like, oh, it's so weird, at night it works and then during the day it stops working. So the surrounding materials that would bounce light into the sensor were really important. And so being able to characterize weird things became really important too. But for me personally, while I hated it at the time and while that led to my next layoff, it's really great experience because I got to measure a whole bunch of different weird materials. And now when I'm having to just make guesses when I'm working with startups and they don't have characterized anything, I'm pretty good at that. It's a weird superpower that I have now. And probably one of the most interesting things that I found, which might be an assumption that someone might make if they're building an illumination system or any optical system, is just like white, the reflectance of something light. So we would use a barium sulfate block, which is like 99 whatever percent reflective, as the,
right. As the standard, the, right?
Yeah, to prove that my SOP that I created worked. And we did that in ASAP, and I created this this fake like machine that would measure it all the different angles. Like, it was kind of an adorable algorithm, if I do say so myself. but we had that block, and then I measured just white paper one day because I was curious and I expected to be pretty much the same. I'm like, this is very Lambertian, and yeah, nope, it's like 80% reflective. It's so much less. And so, especially if you're trying to get a really high efficiency illumination design and you just put in some white thing, you could lose 20% right there of your light. So that's something I warn startups about all the time, is like, just because something looks like something else doesn't mean anything. You really need to be characterizing your materials and getting them actually measured whenever possible.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, I did eventually get some work. I definitely made an enemy with my boss, like making sure like that I got on to some projects that I could bring back with me. And that saved me a little bit longer. And then there was another machine vision project that my boss had already outsourced in the US while I was gone. And so when I came back, he had me like supervise that. And it was illumination and also the camera system. And the camera system, again, but like that's going into stuff that I had really no idea about. And so I told them, you know, if this is what you want me to keep doing, I really should have more education. And so I was trying to work with him to find a way to go to U of R to get my master's degree. So I go to U of R and I have a meeting with one of the head professor there. And he was like, well, I mean, you could get a master's degree. We would let you in, but we're not going to pay for it because your grades weren't perfect. And so like my physics professors had told me, like, if you ever hear that, that's an insult. And I was like, but dude, I was working full time and at night, and I was bartending till 4 a.m. And then I had like, so yeah, he's like, well, I guess that just wasn't the right, academic environment for you. Like, no, it was just being poor, you jerk. So,
right.
I had like high, like 88%. Like, we had a WAG, we had out of 100%. We didn't have a GPA. So I had like an 88 or an 87, whatever. It was like C's and D's, get degrees. After a while, you don't care.
Yeah. Again, I, it's astonishing how much of that, like, you have to be the perfect student and you're going to learn this very theoretical, technical stuff, and it'll have no application. Like, a bunch of the time it has no application to you actually being a good engineer, scientist, whatever.
Yeah. They did have a couple classes that looked really cool though. They were like, the type of stuff where you have to learn about manufacturing optics and the stuff that you can't really find in the textbook, and it more comes with just doing it. And they had some courses that were really geared towards that, and that I was really attracted to, but whatever, I did it on my own. So I got it anyway. So yeah, they ended up laying me off though, because the recession hit and I was a fairy tale, like made up position that they didn't really need to begin with. So I was first on the chopping block. And then it was a really long time before I could get a job again. The next year I was talking with a recruiter in Rochester who just specialized in getting optics jobs for people. And he used to be like in a photonics engineer. So like, he's like really great recruiter in that. He's like, Aaron, there's nothing. The first year there was nothing. He's like, I have nothing, not just for you, for anyone. There's nothing in optics.
Right.
And then after that, it was like, it's too bad that you only have 4 years experience because you really need five. Five is the minimum for me to get you in the door. And I had four. So it was like over 2 years that I was like going hungry. And at that time I was helping out my friend who had a kid. And so I was trying to help support them. And so I'm like, well, I'm already living frugally. So the only thing I can cut back on is food. And I dropped so much weight that when I finally had a job at an interview after a year, I put on a suit. And as I was going down the stairs, the pants fell off my waist. And I was living with my brother at the time. And I was like, David, I need your belt right now. I showed up like ridiculous suit that was falling off. And I was constantly afraid that I was going to like moon the people that I was interviewing with. And then I didn't even get the job.
You looked like David Byrne in the Talking Heads video where he's wearing a just giant suit.
Exactly the suit I was wearing, yes. It was so bad. But then afterwards, so it was like just over 2 years, but across the year, calendar-wise. So when HR people read it after that, they're like, oh, 3 years, you haven't had a job. But I'm like, come on, just do some math, just some basic math. That would be great. But eventually, I got hired at Valio Sylvania, which is now just Valio. It was a kind of cooperation between Osram Sylvania and Valio. And they were making exterior automotive lighting. So here's a secret about automotive that most people don't know. A lot of automotive companies, they don't know how to make their own lamps. Someone's going to yell at me for saying lamps, but like headlamp.
right.
They have no idea. A lot of them. Some of them do, like especially like Audi and like the ones who have more money, but many of them don't. The regulations are so crazy to wrap your head around. There's like a huge book that you have to read. And so they'd rather just like make a tier.
Yeah, someone else specialize in it. Right.
So that was super, super, super stressful job because unlike even like with Apple or something, if you had a version of a product that needed to come out in a certain year and it like some part didn't make like fell off the boat from China, that's okay. Okay, we'll push it out a month. We don't have a set time when things need to come out. But with cars, no. The 2021 Escalade comes out in 2021 or it won't be called that anymore. So when things got screwed up, the optical engineers would have to work around the clock. And a lot of times we were also the only ones who could figure out root cause analysis because, you know, optics is at the focal point of an optical design. It always is.
Yeah. No pun intended.
Yeah, right.
And the nice thing too, for the listeners who, you know, haven't had this experience, I'm sure that the car designers were very thoughtful and kind and took into consideration the best mechanical housing for these illumination devices you had to build.
Oh, what a great point. Yeah, they were so great. They were so cool to work with. They were a nightmare. They had no idea. All they cared about was, does this look like a Puma to you?
There's a great I'll link to it. Usually I only link to relevant things, but I'll try to find it again. But there's a great comic, someone saying like, we think that it's weird that we teach our kids about like, I don't know, like we expose our kids to sexuality too young on TV. And then the next frame is a guy talking to his son. He's like, isn't that a sexy car? that's what I'm picturing. Like what animal do you think of when you see this car? So.
Yeah, actually, what is it? There's one of the Jeeps was supposed to be some like a Jaguar or something. And I was like, I hope we don't get this project because I'm embarrassed for you.
Right. Is the Hummer supposed to be a Rhino or something? Is that?
Maybe. I don't know.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's a good point. No, so that like the stylists really are more focused on aesthetics. And the biggest thing that you need, just like with any optical design, is room. You need, the more room you have, the more precise you can aim each ray exactly where you need it. And if you haven't worked in automotive lighting before, the way most of the regulations work are you light up the lamp and you shoot it on a wall, and there are test points you have to meet. Very, very stringent test points. And there's also like certain angles where there has to be visibility at different points in the car. But the bigger one is just like, you shine it on a wall, you get it on the goni, and it has to meet these test points.
And is it literally, I guess this is getting a little too in the weeds, but is it literally like a photometer or something, or like it has to be this, you know, this quote unquote bright at these points?
No, you have a gonio photometer and
it moves and
it tests every single point. And then it'll rotate to make sure you have some, visibility is easy to hit. It just hasn't got any light.
Right.
But like for like a headlamp, you know, there's a cutoff point where you have to have a dark band on top so you're not blinding passengers on the sidewalk. And then there has to be a bright band underneath that. And even stupid things like turn signals and stops and all that stuff, they all have very specific test patterns that you have to meet. And the smaller the cavity that you have to make reflectors or lenses, you know, the less precise each ray you're designing for can be, because you can only it's just like with designing an imaging optic, the more room that you have, the more precise you can direct each ray.
Yeah, there's more things you can play with and tweak. Definitely.
Yeah. So, well, like if you're designing a facet of a reflector and it's really close to the source, then only a very small part of that facet is going to actually point where you want it to go. And the further that you move it away, there's more surface area that actually means something, that does something for you. And the rest is just like, it's mucking it up. And that's still a problem with all sorts of illumination that come up with, but yeah, the stylist didn't really care at all. And so that was a super, super stressful thing. And a lot of it was just because of the whole, hey, this didn't work. They dropped the freaking lamp on your desk and they're like, figure it out. And you're like, my optics is fine. My design is fine. They're like, well, prove it. Cause you're the smartest one here. So prove it. And sometimes it would be like, you know, when we changed the driver, it would have been good if you changed the part number.
right.
Because the optics are fine. Or, you know, like you have multiple cavities of a lens and then only one of them doesn't work. And you're like, okay, so obviously it's not the design. If one of them works and one of them doesn't, but you still have to figure out where the weird part of the cavity mold is messed up. So that was really tough. But again, really great experience for being out in the wild.
Right. And this was, I don't know if it was your first, but it sounds like this is when you made root cause analysis. Like that's your bread and butter. To some extent, because, you know, we have people who listen to this who are, you know, we have a lot of grad students or students in general who listen to this. And I didn't know it until I was, you know, actually working of like, that is a big part or potentially a big part of your job of like, hey, this doesn't work, figure it out. And you're kind of sitting there like, what? Like, what do you mean figure it out? So yeah, an underappreciated skill to have.
Yeah. And it's really good as a freelance consultant too, because a lot of the times, just like when I was working in a company, you get feedback, especially if you're working with foreign vendors. And you're doing high volume, like you never expect the first part to work. And so you have to be able to push back and be like, defend your design and be like, no, let's look at some other things here to make sure that your reputation is intact at the end of the day, which I had to do in automotive all the time, every day. And then I fled there and I went to Chicago. So that was in Seymour, Indiana, in the middle of nowhere. I turned 30. I'm like, there's no one to date except my coworkers, and I don't mix business with pleasure. This sucks. And so when I got to go to Chicago, that was like, wow, this is the first time I've ever lived in a big city. This is amazing. Too bad I'm getting paid dog food. So I was actually working in Des Plaines in the suburbs, but I was like, nope, I'm living in the city because enough of that, enough with the small town, whatever. And that was like an hour and a half commute each way. So 3 hours a day, and then plus 9 hours at work, so it's 12-hour days. So I'm still like working 12-hour days, but there's a bit less stress because then I moved into just like normal illumination for houses and restaurants and your track lighting in your kitchen. I was like, there's no way you guys could screw this up as bad as you screwed up automotive headlamps. There's no way. So that was kind of my thinking about why I was like, okay, this could be a good, less stress thing.
And it how did that pan out?
Huh?
How did that pan out?
Well, like the engineering work was less stressful, but here's the catch 22, Logan. When you work in developing technology that's really hard to develop, the people around you are automatically humbled because they're coming up against challenges each and every day that are like, oh, I don't know how to solve this. And it knocks their ego down a few pegs. When you're working on something that's easy, there is nothing to stop the ego from continuing to inflate and inflate and inflate. And so the people I was working with, like some of them are amazing and I love them and I still talk to them. And others, well, then I quit. So that it was definitely, yeah, there was some sexism there that impeded my ability to just do my job. And that's all I cared about. And that kind of Midwest mentality, I think, was kind of helped by the fact that it was such an easy thing to produce. So it was hard, right, but for different reasons.
Yeah. And did it, before you move on, I'm really curious to hear as well, did your level of education impact that, I don't know what the right word is, entitlement, well, you know, whatever, that other people are saying like, you know, no, we know best. How could you suggest something different? I have no doubt sexism played into it. I'm curious though, if in addition, education was a factor.
There are lots of doctorates there, Logan. You think there are lots of doctors that were making those track lights for your kitchen? There was one.
Well,
and he was great. And that was the thing, though.
Okay, I mean,
that was the thing, because if you've gone through a doctorate program, you are automatically humbled.
I don't know if I fully agree with that. I can point to exceptions, I suppose, but the reason I say it is, I had a friend who got his bachelor's in optics, but he had experienced, you know, at different jobs, people saying like, well, I have my master's or doctorate. Why are you telling me otherwise?
Interesting.
And it's, I didn't experience it.
Well, good.
But you know, that's because I'm so smart that no one would ever question me, obviously. You know, it's, but it, anyways, so sorry for interrupting. So you quit there.
So actually, just to back up a bit, like a lot of those people were grandfathered in. So some of them didn't even have college education, period. So I was actually interviewing for three jobs at the end. I was interviewing at Apple to be a program manager for the illumination part of it.
Cool.
Actually, like the optics manager was actually impressed. Like I guessed the focal length of their Fresnel lens. And he's like, This is shockingly accurate. And he had to take a moment and pause. But they didn't like that I wasn't formally trained in program management.
Right.
Okay, whatever. Right. So I was interviewing there. I was interviewing at Amazon, the 126 lab, Lab 126 or whatever it is. And then I was interviewing at, it would have been a sales engineering position in Chicago. And that would have been fun, because I would be like building different systems on a lab bench for different customers, improving. I was like, oh, that sounds cool. That sounds cool. But they didn't like that I didn't have sales experience. And at the same time, as I was interviewing, I was like, okay, I'm done. At the same time as I was interviewing, I was living with crazy people that I met on Craigslist, because I wasn't getting paid enough to live not only just in Chicago, but like even in Des Plaines. I wouldn't have been able to afford that. I lost my car at one point. I hit a pothole and then that just like, it was dead. So I didn't have a car. So it was like polar vortex weather and I'm taking a train and a bus and a train out at this point.
Yeah,
it was torture. Like I was close. you know, being a desperate situation. And so I had to tell myself, like, all right, I'm going to give myself like an out somehow mentally, that if by chance, of course, one of these companies is going to hire me, but if they don't, what do I do? I need to know that at the end of this lease that I have something. And so I told myself, oh, just sell everything I own and leave the country. And then I think like 6 or 7 weeks before I was about to, the lease was going to be up, the third job said no. And I was like, oh my God, I'm well, okay. I guess I'm quitting my job and leaving the country. So I did that. So.
Which I sorry to keep jumping
please,
in here,
no, but you're hearing me.
I think that's kind of really underrated. I've
leaving been leaving it all behind you.
Well, no, I mean, yes, kind of, but like having the mentality of like, man, things are terrible. How can I assume some control over the situation? Even if you have to take something as, you know, as in my opinion, like pretty out there, is like, cool, okay, we're going to sell it all. And
it
back.
Was drastic too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's underrated finding ways to assume control over situations when you feel like, wow, this is out of control. As a general statement, it's interesting. I've had that experience in my own jobs and school, and my girlfriend in teaching early on in teaching had that experience of like, this is nightmarish and I don't have control over anything. It's all going downhill, and being able to say at least like, well, I have control over some things, can be really important. So
yeah.
Anyway, sorry for that diatribe.
I think it has to do with your breaking point too. And if it's just like, well, I think I can hold on a little longer. And then when you're actually like, nope, I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think like explicitly stating it is super important because I've seen people just have like straight breakdowns.
Yeah.
Like just strict, like, yeah, no, you snap. Yeah. I've had like multiple friends, especially in grad school, have witnessed people do that. And it's because I think that taking the perspective of like, this is crazy, but I'll just grin and bear it. And then I'll stop grinning and I'll just bear it. And you keep going and then you snap. And there's there's never that like forethought of like, if it gets to here, done, you know, like fine. I know my limit. So.
Yeah. And that's the key part, right? Like is knowing yourself that much, to know actually how much you can take and how much you can't take. And a lot of times we overestimate ourselves or we feel guilty for giving up on something. When really it's like, well, who cares if you give up, if like going forward breaks you?
Right.
Yeah.
Literally, I mean, it sounds like you have an incredible amount of endurance, but you're saying, you know, when you're in that difficult situation prior to that job and you're like losing a ton of weight, like having physical symptoms of like, man, you're enduring a ton. You can do that in a job as well. Like you can be so stressed or you cannot have enough time to eat or exercise or whatever. So anyways, I always like to push on that because I hate to see people in school or early in their career sacrifice like mental health or physical health for like, well, like I almost named a company and I should not do that, but like, it's the company I always wanted to work at. So how could I complain about it kind of thing?
I'll do it. But Apple's amazing.
Yeah, I guess.
that's a really super important point. And that's behind a lot of what I do now. Like when I was doing the automotive stuff, a lot of my coworkers were going through it too. We had one party that we went to where we were all sitting around complaining and one of the engineer's wives was there and she's like, oh my God, thank you guys so much. For what? For talking crap about our company that we work for? And she's like, I thought he was making it up. I didn't think it could be that bad, but it is. They're like, oh no, it's that bad. And she was like, I had no idea. And sometimes people would come in. Me and my one coworker, we came in the same week. We hadn't moved our neck at night and we couldn't, our necks were like whiplash.
Yeah, yeah.
For a week, both of us at the same time. It was like an epidemic. No, it gets crazy. But it's also good to know that it's not like that everywhere. And that was another thing my coworkers didn't realize. Some of them, like they got right out of grad school. They went to Rose Hallman. They got their master's in optics. They go right down the street to, you know, Indiana and get their job. And they're like, but it's like this everywhere. No, it's not. No.
Right.
And that was another thing why I was like kind of lucky that I was laid off so many times, is because I had no choice but to see that it's different everywhere. So I guess maybe I should back up. When I was in Values, Pennsylvania, I was like, this sucks. I don't want to continue doing this. I need to start doing something on the side. And I was like, I was really seriously considering getting an MBA or a master's in engineering management. But then I was like looking above me in the org chart, and I'm like, y'all aren't happy, and you're not like using any of the skills that would be in any of these degrees. And eventually I was like, you know what do I actually want though? Do I want to be in that? Or do I just think like I need that job so that I can pay off my loans so that eventually I can have my own thing? And I was like, well, I just want my own thing. So like, I was like, Aaron, why just take the shortcut? And so instead of putting money into an MBA, I decided I would start an LLC. And that was my rationale. Like, I'm going to invest money into this and it doesn't need to go anywhere, but I'm going to learn and I'm going to build a structure and I'm going to have this playbox, this sandbox that I can play in and experiment, and I'll figure it out as I go along. So I started in 2011 is when I started my company. And I've been experimenting ever since then on the side. And so when I quit my job in 2015, I was like, all right, I guess we're going full time with this. But I already have the structure like there.
Right. And this company, so in 2011, is Spire Starter? Yeah. Okay.
And that's why it makes no sense. Like the name like means nothing.
Hey, I didn't say anything about that. So you started Spire Starter. You're doing, it's an LLC and you are doing freelance work.
No, right? No. I like wrote a book for the first thing and I bought swag from China and it was a research project, and then I killed it. And I tried other things with it to like sell things online and get used to digital marketing and totally random things, having nothing to do with engineering. I tried to get into doing contracting, but the people who are already there, I don't know, they thought it was a lot easier because they like already had a network when they started and I didn't have one yet. So I wasn't able, I tried, but I wasn't able to get into freelancing at that point on the side. And it's really hard to do that on the side because everyone wants to talk during the day. And I was working like crazy hours at the time and wasn't possible. So when I eventually quit in 2015 and I was like, okay, bye, put my stuff in storage that I couldn't sell. And I went to Ireland. And then a few months later, Ireland kicked me out. Immigration. I went to Asia. I backpacked around there until my flight was back from Ireland to the U.S. And then they let me in again. And so like that was supposed to be my time to just sit and concentrate and be alone and not have distractions and just do more experimentation, but like full time. And that didn't work. And so, but then when I came back, I was really, 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 really sick. And I continued to deteriorate for like 6 months and none of the doctors could figure out what was wrong. I continued to try to go to specialists in New York City for the next year and a half. I finally gave up on them. And then, you know, like, I, so like today I'm much better than I was. But for the very long time, I told no one about it because you can't get a job if people actually know, you know, what your needs are, because they will make assumptions based on, you know, they're trying to mitigate their risk. So I hid that, but now I feel like I'm at a point where it's okay. I could talk about it because I'm feeling pretty secure about where I am comparatively. But to make money, I had to come up, like, I couldn't get contract jobs because my resume was so checkered at that point. You know, like it was impossible to even get a call back from recruiters. So that was my original, like, okay, if I can't figure out something in Ireland, then I'll just come back and I'll get like a 6 month contract and then I'll figure it out again. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that because I couldn't get hired, and I couldn't do that because I was too sick to do a full-time job on site. And so I would walk into companies in New York City and say, look, you don't have to pay me anything unless I get you a sale. Let me do sales for you. And so I did just commission-only sales and marketing. for the most part. Some stuff I did a bit hourly just to, because I would have died without it. But yeah, so, and I thought back to like that one job that wouldn't hire me because I didn't have sales experience. And I'm like, got it now. What? I got it.
Right. Look at me now, right?
Yeah. So sometimes like if you, and that's the cool thing about being on the outside of the corporation is that you can just like start, you can just do it. You can just do it. You can just sell yourself and then do that thing that you couldn't get experience inside the box with. And it's the same with engineering work. So I did that for a while and then eventually got sucked back into optical engineering. And I worked with a bunch of different contractors. And sometimes I'd bug you about different things that were in imaging that I couldn't do. And that was continuing to grow. And every year my revenue was doubling. And like last year was going to be the year that like I was like, I didn't have to travel full time. So during that entire time, I lived out of a backpack. I had, I had no home. I was home.
And you, and I mean, part of that, my understanding too, part of that is you're traveling around and you're finding customers.
Yeah.
Which for people who are considering consulting work that have never done it, getting consulting work is really hard. And like at the outset, wow, it's really hard. Until we, we've done a bit of consulting work, and until we met you, it was like, wait, how do I find people that need my help? Like, how does this work? And I remember talking to you, you'd say, I'm in Texas, I'm in California, I'm here, like literally going and finding people, which, is what you have to do.
Yeah.
At least early on or something. So.
Absolutely. That is for sure the hardest part. And especially with optical engineering, if you're building a larger product and just had the small pieces of optics, they don't need you full time for the whole 2 years of development or whatever it is. They're going to need you for 2 weeks here and a month there and whatever. So a lot of it is just like timing. So you might find clients your first year, but they don't need you for another 2 years. And so that's why it takes several years of slowly building up your contacts before you have all of the popcorn kernels going off at the same time that you have enough to eat. And for me, that was going to be last year. But yeah, what I found, and I experimented with lots of different marketing, and I used all of my experience from working with other startups that I was helping before. And the same like routes of the travel routes and the same meetups, like I got to duplicate all of that research that I'd done for them, for my own company. But I found that the in-person stuff, the ROI, the return on investment of going to that meeting and having a beer with that person was way, way better than sending out 100 cold emails or sending out or calling people cold. And even if you did call someone cold and you got through, you still needed to visit them in person to finish the deal and to push it through. And sometimes people would be interested, but it was like the in-person visit that finally got the contract signed. So it was hugely, hugely important that the in-person stuff, physical travel, even though it was so hard on my body, especially when I was sick. It was like, when is this ever going to end? And I was like, okay, 2020 is my year. And then the world shut down and it's just like lockdowns everywhere. And so that was one huge problem. That was my main way of closing contracts. And there is like a whole bunch of other digital marketing stuff that you can do. And that I do and that do bring in contracts. And I wrote a whole book about it on branding for physical product engineers.
And what's the name of that book? We'll link to it as well.
Cool. It's Freelancers Framework Guidebook 1, Building Brand. And then there's a big subtitle. But
yeah.
Because I'm hoping to do more books, because that's not all you need to know to be a freelancer, but it's the most important thing. And like, if you build your brand, if you start like showing the world that you have value and that you can bring, you can help fix problems or answer questions and different things, and you leave these little nuggets behind on Reddit or on a forum or whatever, on a LinkedIn post, then those can be things that will blossom later on, even if you're a student at the time. And
yeah, absolutely.
So like,
And again, maybe my perspective is getting harsher and harsher the longer I'm out of school, but there are so many tangible things to learn that you aren't taught in school. And especially for Even if you're not doing freelance work, I think a lot of the insights you have in your book are applicable, you know, to any kind of job or like promoting yourself anywhere. So I definitely would recommend it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. No, of course. So 2020, not a good year, right?
Not a good year. I'd actually, for the first time in many years, I actually rented a place in Austin because it was South by Southwest. I'm like, okay, Austin's a big tech city. I'm going to go to South by Southwest.
I remember this. I remember talking to you when you were like, yeah, I'm going to head to South by Southwest and maybe you'd come to Arizona afterwards.
Yeah, that was the plan. So South by Southwest got shut down, and it was such a huge investment for me too, because I was doing a lot of like house sitting and watching people's dogs up until that point. And I finally like couldn't deal with that anymore. And this was like just to pay rent somewhere. It was like, oh, this is a huge investment in my business. And then that happened. I'm like, this was a huge, terrible investment in my business. And I still had contracts that were coming through from work that I'd done like years previously that I was continuing to like tend to those clients, and they finally turned into contracts. But you know, again, I was expecting that year to be like the final one when I had to do the last big push of marketing and sales and the traveling. So I had already given a lot of that work away to subcontractors. I was still making some, but the point was so that I could continue. Yeah, so I had contracts coming in, but I'd already promised them to other people to subcontract to before 2020. So like my revenue went way down. And then on top of that, like there were projects where they didn't go through the way that I wanted them to. And I had to pay for, you know, extra things, or I had to spend extra time to like clean up reports or something to put them in the level of report that I wanted, because the person I was subcontracting to, like they were still in a employee mindset. And so I was taking on like all this risk, and I wasn't getting much of a percentage back. And I was noticing also that I was sending out more work than I was getting leads back in, even though like I would tell people, hey, I'll give you a percentage I'll give you a referral fee if you send me a contract. And then people would forget. And I would send them a check. They're like, what is this for? Like, did you forget? Would you have been sending me more work if you remembered? So like I saw that there's definitely value in working with a network and not being like tight-fisted about contracts. Like there is value in that, but the way I was doing it was not efficient. And I thought maybe there's a way that I can systemize like this network that I have a little better so that we all benefit more consistently and reliably. And also removing some of the risk. And at the same time, a different way of promotion that I don't have to be physically there for, that could be an aid to this other way of promotion, which isn't enough on its own. Just commenting on Reddit is not going to bring me all the clients I need. So that's why I shut down my all business for engineering in like August, maybe. And then I was concentrating on freelancing platforms. And I studied that for a few months. I got involved in a group called OpenAssembly. And it's like all the people who lead like freelancer.com and Upwork and Toptal, and they're all in this. So I learned from them about how they're doing their groups. And after a few months, I was like, all right, I'm going to build my own. Like at first I was like, okay, maybe I just need to write a book for other people. Cause one of my kind of advisors, Randall Chinnock, he was like, why don't you just help other people go freelance? I was like, okay, yeah, maybe I'll do that. But then as I'm interviewing other engineers, I'm like, oh my God, you guys need so much more than a book. So like, okay, also the book, but then a freelancing platform. So in, January 26th, I started on Engineer, and you graciously jumped on board that crazy train ride of experiments. So thank you, Logan.
Of course, happy to be a part of it.
And yeah, it's just an experiment. So it's 4 months long. It's going to end in just over 2 months from now. And if it doesn't prove itself, then I'm not going to continue. I hope it does, but I can't keep just experimenting.
Right. And I mean, I think that's kind of the nature of, gosh, you know, I'm tempted to say startups, but I think it's broader than that. Yeah. The nature of kind of figuring out what works, right, is like you try it, see if it works. If it works, great. If it doesn't, change it. But for our listeners, you know, to be a little bit more detailed about Odd Engineer, can you explain kind of what niche it's trying to fill and how it operates?
So it's just focused on physical product development, and it is optics heavy, but it wasn't intentionally that way. I was trying to get a broad spectrum of different physical product development engineers. The idea behind that is that anyone going to the site would be able to find at least one person that could help them in their development. And this could be for a larger manufacturing team that needs specific guidance on something and they don't have a certain engineer on staff. And that happens all the time in optics. Like half the companies that need optical engineers don't have one, but that happens for other specialties too. And so the MVP, the minimum viable product, is just really, really simple. It's only 1 hour consultations, and you book and you pay for it immediately and you upload your NDA. And people are asking me now, like, about my rates. I'm like, I don't have rates. It's just a platform. Everyone picks their own rates. They send me a percentage. And again, that's just for this trial period to see, like, how this needs to be structured and if this is a viable way to get people to connect with new pain clients.
Right.
So I've gotten two already, two appointments. Nice. I'm like, oh no, I wanted to be for someone else.
Right, right. But you know, I think it makes a lot of sense in my experience from consulting is a lot of times people only need an hour or 2 hours, you know, they do not need like, oh, okay, it's going to be a month or 2 month long consulting process. And having that ability to kind of just like quickly chat, say, okay, yeah, that's an interesting idea for your product, but probably don't do this or maybe consider this. Or even being at the perspective of like, you definitely need an optical engineer. If it's optics, you definitely need an optical engineer. You can either hire me for, you know, like 100 hours of work or just hire an optical engineer. Like getting that amount of information in an hour talk is super valuable.
Yeah, I think so. And I was doing that for free for a while just to more as a way to like, do you need this or don't you? And how much do you actually need? So it was like a pre-sales consultation. But as I think we both saw, some of the companies were trying to use that as like free optical engineering period. And so that's another thing that this can kind of help get around with Odd Engineers. Like, no, you just pay for it and then you get the hours worth. And also, you know that you're not going to be like sold to. It's you getting value in that 1 hour.
And right, done. Right.
And on the freelancer side, it's also like, it's taking away a lot of the annoying paperwork and stuff. That like normally we don't do 1 hour consultations. We're not going to set you up in our payment system and create an invoice and all the, does Wednesday work for you or does Thursday? Like, oh no.
Right, right. You just log on, say what time you can talk or want to talk, and then that's it. It's all set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that works. I don't know. At the same time, I'd like to build out other resources for freelancers. Maybe at a job board for the company side, but I'm really more focused on helping the engineers. Because one thing that happened when I went on my sabbatical was I had all these people coming to me like, okay, I know why you left, because you weren't happy, right? I'm also not happy and my body's breaking down. Or I was just hospitalized because I have heart problems now because of my stress levels, or I just tried to kill myself. I was getting lots of emails like that. So I want to make it easier for us to jump into freelancing and have more of a support system if we do want to do that. And I'm never going to be able to have all the structures there that are needed, but I think there can be ways to like make that first hump where you need that starting momentum to be insanely high to be a little bit less. That's what I'm hoping to do overall. So yeah, if people have like suggestions or things that they want to see, this is another playground, you know, like, and if I build another one, it's going to look much different than the one now. So like, tell me what you want to see.
Yeah, it's an evolution. And I'll be sure as well to link to Odd Engineer so that listeners can go and see the website, see the Odd Engineers that are on there, and contact you if they have ideas or whatnot.
Yeah, and there's also some giveaways right now. So like, if you're a student who wants to get into, you know, one of these tracks, like there's several different optical people there, and they all have their own companies or their own freelancing things that they've done. You want to talk to any of them? you can enter the giveaway, and I'm going to pay for people to have appointments for not just engineering consulting, but like learning how to go freelance or how to get into a new career, like, because we can all consult on that too.
I'd forgotten about entirely spaced on the giveaways, but that's another great thing to check out.
I think for a lot of 23rd.
Okay, sorry, when was it again?
The 23rd is the last day you can register.
Okay.
And one grand prize winner gets the Bose noise canceling headphones. So I hope.
Okay, I will, and that's the 23rd of March.
Yes.
Okay, we're recording this on the 16th, so I will quickly process this and get it uploaded then. But you know, I think it's surprising. Basically, most people that I've met have a niche skill at the very least. Yeah. Some people have really broad, great skills and they're just fantastic, whatever. But you know, people like myself, I have a niche skill, and having the opportunity to do freelance work is doing freelance work. Period. It's a lot of fun. You're your boss. But getting to do freelance work when you're applying your niche skill, there's nothing like it, because that's when it's like you're blazing away and the people that hired you are like, oh my God. Like honestly, I've been fortunate enough to do consulting jobs where I get to apply my niche skill, and it's like, I know this is phenomenal value for you, and you guys know it's phenomenal value, and like, nobody else can do this. And that's so fulfilling and enjoyable and stressful sometimes, but in comparison to a standard job where it's like, oh my God, I just went in for 8 or 9 hours and then I'll do that tomorrow and then again and again and again, and it's not fulfilling and it's stressful also, and et cetera. So yeah, I mean, having that freelance network and potential would be incredible, so.
Yeah, and the narrowing down your niche thing is really important to be able to do the 1 hour of guidance to like cold. So, I mean, anyone with a background in objects could, if they're sat down in a permanent job, could eventually figure out the thing. But to go in cold without having like read up on a project or data sheets or CAD or anything, and just like give feedback that's valuable, it needs to be like something you've already had experience in that's in your special niche. And so that's why it's really important to figure that out, which was actually a hard part for a lot of the engineers that I brought on. It's like really reevaluating their skills. And I think it was a good exercise though to do for a lot of them, because they're like, oh, I never thought about it this way or that way. And some of them thought they didn't have it. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, you totally do.
Yeah, I was one of the people that said like, oh, I don't have too many niche skills, you know, but it's kind of like when you know, for people who are students or even outside of students, if you've ever had that opportunity to talk to a professor who's just like the person at their subject, if you consider, I was trying to explain it as an analogy to a friend the other day that they were like, oh yeah, like, I mean, how much do you charge? How'd you decide on your rate for, you know, when I told you my rate? And I was explaining like, how much did you pay for college, right? How much did you pay for a course? And it's thousands or tens of thousands of dollars or whatever it might work out to. And you're trying to say like, imagine talking to that professor and them distilling like, this is the essence of my knowledge for that problem you have. Like, man, that's valuable.
So. And just being able to find that professor is another huge like time waste, especially for startups that are trying to find like these needle and haystack engineers that know this very specific thing. So if this builds, it would be really great to have lots of weird little niche specialties represented.
Right now,
we only got like 13.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard. I can see it being really hard from the client side as well of like, do people do this? You know, like, has anyone seen this problem that I have? And if it is super niche, it's like, how do I find it? I'll Google it. Nothing will show up. That's a chronic problem in optics, is you Google it and you're like, cool, nobody's ever commented on this. Perfect.
Which is great. You have your forum on Ely Optics, and I always send people over there and they ask me questions. Like, I don't know. Yeah, ask these people.
Yeah, good. Thank you. And we're constantly trying to build that to be a better resource. So, So cool. So you're doing Odd Engineer right now and seeing how it works out. Is there anything specific planned for the future, or it's just see how it goes and then go from there?
We'll see how this goes. There are lots of other platforms that are in physical product development that are kind of tangential things that I'm talking with those leaders right now and see if we can find a way to kind of pool our resources and provide more to people and help build a real community. Cause I think that's a really key part that none of us have. Like, and that's something that you really need when you're starting out. Cause you can't go like, go to the water cooler at your corporate job and be like, hey, so I'm thinking about starting an LLC. You know how to do that, Joe? Like, you get fired. So like the community aspect is something I'd really like to build out for sure. And there is a forum on Odd Engineer. If anyone has like questions like that, they can submit it to the forum. And even though there are other people there now, like I can put that out to my network. Or if you want to put like an anonymous question, you can send that through the contact form and I will submit that for you. And I will point eyes onto your question. I'll get it answered because yeah, that's something I can do now because I'm on the outside and I'm not going to get fired for asking those questions. So
yeah, I guess you could, but you won't be firing yourself for
got it.
cool. Yeah. Well, I highly recommend our listeners go and check it out. And honestly, you know, especially if you're a student, go and post questions or go and ask these questions because earlier is better to figure it out when you can. Earlier is better to ask the questions, I guess. So I think that about covers that section. If there's anything else you'd like to talk about, let me know. Otherwise, I usually have a closing segment where, you know, we talk about non-optic stuff. But before we get there, if there's any other advice or topic you like covered, just let me know.
No, let's do it.
Good. All right. So the final section is overrated versus underrated. I have grossly stolen this from another podcast, Conversations with Tyler. And yeah, so, you know, I make no bones about it. So I say something, you say if it's overrated, underrated, or accurately rated. I was going to say easy. I don't know if it's easy. TikTok.
Underrated.
How come? It's one of the most popular things. It's underrated. Oh, yeah,
because people our age are like crapping on it. And I already got a video to go viral. So there's huge potential there right now. And I also use the video software itself to create a lot of the videos that I push to like LinkedIn, whatever, just because it's so fast. Like I save hours in editing, because just like you, I hate it. I hate editing. It's the worst thing, but it's so fast in TikTok. So yeah, but also there is potential reach there, and there are people in physical product development, especially if they have like cool things that make cool lights or spin or move in. Like
they're
blowing up on TikTok. So yeah, you can reach a totally different audience and also have far reach on that platform. It's one of the best. Like Instagram, it's crap now. Like Facebook, there are groups that can't even reach their own members anymore when they're just normally posting without promoting. The second best.
So TikTok's, I'm still, trying to find the perfect dance video to recreate. And that's when I'll start my TikTok account.
It's not all dancing.
Yeah, exactly. The next one is,
I think the guy from Edmund Optics was watching my TikTok videos and now they're on TikTok.
Ooh, okay. All right. Perfect. So it's already spreading. Perfect. So the next one then is telling somebody, I don't know.
Underrated or overrated? Can I pass? Like, you don't know. I don't know. I guess
you can pass too.
I just said I don't know.
Oh, there you go. You answered it with the. I've found in my experience it's underrated because the consequences of not saying you don't know when you don't can be bad.
Yeah, but then there's also you can still answer a question while qualifying it, which is kind of an I don't know, but
Yeah, right. And you know, listening to you explain how you got to where you are, I think there's a distinct difference between like, I don't know and I can't know. And, you know, I don't know, I can't get there, I can't learn it, whatever. And I don't know, but I'll figure it out.
If you're talking like freelancing, it's always best, especially if the person you're talking to doesn't understand what you do, you still have to show you're competent. So you can say like, well, this is similar to this. The part I don't know is this, but if I were to guess based on this other knowledge that I have, you at least need to watch out for the A and B. And so I try to frame my replies that way, not lying, but still giving some sort of value in every response. I know a guy who does know that or something.
Yeah, no, definitely. What's the right way to phrase it? I was going to say it, and I consider this a complimentary phrase, but maybe it's not. So if it's not, I apologize. But I was going to say vagabonding, or like the state of constantly traveling. And if it is offensive, then, you know, then I am extremely sorry. And let me just say,
no, I think I have that on my like developed 3D column bio.
Okay, perfect.
It's fine. I think it's overrated. Definitely overrated. I'm not doing it for fun. And people think that I'm doing it for fun. And I actually met like Nomadic Matt. I don't know if you know. Like,
oh, yeah.
I met him in Austin. Not a big fan. But he was like, so how long have you been a full-time nomad? I'm like, I don't know, like 5 years. And he's like, that's nothing. And I'm like, I'm not trying to be.
This wasn't a competition, right?
this is my hell. I do this to survive. And he has a full-time place in Austin, by the way. So he's not really a nomad.
You heard it here first. when I was in high school, one of my favorite teachers that I've ever had, he was great because he would constantly disagree. Like no matter what position you took, he would be like, no, I disagree and argue. And I think that's undervalued in education. But I remember I was like, I'm just going to travel. You know, like I just want to travel. And he's like, yeah, but what about having a home? And I was an idiot high school. And I was like,
overrated.
I don't know who needs it. You know, I'll be traveling. And he did as he usually did and called me out. So thank you, Mr. Rob Gerard, for challenging my idiocy in high school. The next one that I was going to ask, I'm blanking on. Oh, there we go. Chicago.
Oh, I don't know if it'll ever be the same. So I think it was underrated before, but anything going forward is going to be overrated.
I was just there recently. I used to visit my cousins because they went to college up there, and visiting in August, man, it was the best. Visiting, and this was, I don't know, 9 or 10 or so years ago. Visiting recently, it was definitely different. So hard to say, I guess. That's also how I feel about like San Francisco, though, or a lot of California now. Just to offend any listeners I have from there. To offend all of them, I strongly dislike the Bay Area now. But anyways.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like I used to love Chicago. And the first time I went to San Francisco was for the Apple interview. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. It was like March in Chicago. And then I went out there. Yes, it's not the same. I miss the good old days.
Yeah, that's how we know we're getting old. Oh, back in my day. I feel like it used to have a lot more character. And that's really how I know that I'm getting old, is when you say that.
They use different guns then. It was.
Yeah, exactly. So the last one, because this is a constant topic that I've been harping on recently, and again, it makes me able to offend listeners and friends alike. So back to pop culture, Taylor Swift.
Overrated.
Is there, Okay, fair enough. Is there what genre of music? I'm just going to flip this on its head because it's my podcast and I can. What genre of music is underrated, in your opinion? Obviously,
I like dubstep, and I'm not ashamed to say that.
Do you have an artist you recommend?
Black Mill is what I like to paint to.
All right.
And then when I would be doing optical simulations, I would pick classical Ludovico Einaudi did like the diamond commercial music.
Nice.
But for me, like songs with lyrics screw up my brain.
Yeah. Distracting or.
Yeah, like I like them, but I can't do any other work when they're on.
Right. I would always listen to Aphex Twin a lot when I do programming work. Yeah, and there was a period of time
when I programmed the missiles. It was Aphex all the time.
Yeah, when I was stressed with some of the programming I was doing for for another project. I was listening to a lot of metal. I was getting deeper and deeper into heavy metal. And I knew like, I can gauge how much it's like melodic and how much it's just going into like pure screaming. That's how I can judge how stressed I am. So.
I love how you're using it as like a psychological test.
Yeah, it was a good indicator for me. So. Awesome. Well, yeah, great. I don't have any other questions. If you have anything else you'd like to say, by all means, or any other topics you want to cover, or is that good?
Yeah, well, there's also, there's a waiting list if people want to join Auto Engineer. I don't know if we'll be able to get them on in the pilot, but they will join that. And there's lots of other stuff on there. So just like root around, and if anyone wants to help me out with it and let me know what they want to see again, please let me know, because I'm not building this to make money out of it, like, and squeeze people of dollars. It's really more, my main thing is to help other people have a support system and have the tools they need, not to like jump in the river like my friend John tried to do. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I encourage people to go check that out. So, Aaron, thanks so much for being a guest.
Thank you so much for having me, Logan. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.